Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. This month marks 2 years since the Caldor fire ignited and ripped through parts of El Dorado, Alpine, and Amador counties. The wildfire grew to roughly 220,000 acres, destroying over 1,000 homes and structures, as well as forcing evacuations through the foothills and near Lake Tahoe. But the town hardest hit was Grizzly Flats. The small Sierra community, about an hour east of Sacramento, was nearly leveled. Roughly two-thirds of the homes, which butt up against the El Dorado National Forest, were destroyed. And now, some survivors want to hold the U.S. Forest Service responsible, claiming it long knew the wildfire risk, yet failed to fully protect residents. This latest development follows an investigation from CAP Radio and the California Newsroom, which last year found the Forest Service identified the wildfire risk in Grizzly Flats decades ago and developed a forest management plan, yet completed only a fraction of the work leading up to the Caldor fire. The reporter behind that investigation is Scott Rodd, and he joins us now with more on what a lawsuit could accomplish. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning, Vicky. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time. So let's quickly walk through a timeline before we dive into what's unfolding right now. You covered the Caldor fire extensively in 2021. Describe the terrain and the conditions that really created a worst case scenario for the town of Grizzly Flats.
Well, you have a small rural community that sits on top of a ridge. It's surrounded by canyons that at the time were overloaded with heavy fuels, lots of brush. There was a lot of old growth, large trees, which typically are resilient to fires. But when you have an area that hasn't seen fire in a long time, we're talking decades, probably some of the areas, close to a century that hadn't seen fire. There's the possibility that there's the likelihood that those fuels underneath, when they get so overgrown, that can create a fire scenario that causes those larger trees to also ignite. And that's what happened in Grizzly Flats. You had, again, a heavily wooded area and canyons where the fire had a few days where it burned and sort of took off up these canyons and had a running start before it hit Grizzly Flats on top of that ridge. And it was at such an intensity at that point that it just blew right through the community and destroyed over 400 homes in the community of about 600 homes.
I mean, unfortunately, it wasn't the only wildfire that you covered that year. Remind us what led to you looking into the U.S. Forest Service's handling, specifically of the Caldor fire and how it impacted Grizzly Flats residents. What was different about this one?
It definitely was not the only fire that I covered or that you covered. That year, 2021, was a bad year for fire in California. Some really big destructive fires hit. And I covered the Caldor fire closely as it was burning, and I revisited it because I'd been told I'd been tipped by a forester who said, there was some planned work, some planned forest management work around Grizzly Flats that just hadn't gotten done. And it was, from that sort of basic generic tip that I started looking into it further, and I found that the Forest Service had actually planned a large project around Grizzly Flats. It had started, it had launched the project years and years ago, over a decade ago, and work on the project, only a fraction of the work got done before the Caldor fire ignited, even though they had years to complete it.
Yeah, I think you found, about 14% of the project was completed by the time the Caldor fire started, correct?
That's right. It was a project of about 15,000 acres. It would have included brush clearing, some tree thinning, lots of prescribed burning, but a small fraction of the work got done. And virtually none of the prescribed burning got done, which is really an essential piece of it, reintroducing low-intensity fire to an area to try to make it ultimately more fire resilient. But that work, very little of that work got done before the Caldor fire ignited. And again, that was, that project bordered all around Grizzly Flats and was designed to protect it from fire. Ultimately, the Caldor fire had ignited and burned right through that unfinished project before it hit Grizzly Flats.
This investigation that you did, it started last year, but it really gained notice across the country. It even led up to Congress. What has been the aftermath?
Yeah, Congress took notice. There was a delegation of over a dozen representatives, both senators from California, who wrote a letter to the Forest Service and demanded answers based on our investigation. They said this is troubling. There were promises made. There was work that clearly was identified that needed to get done, but it didn't. And lo and behold, the worst case scenario happened. The Forest Service had essentially predicted 20 years ago that a fire like this could happen and wipe out Grizzly Flats. And unfortunately, that prediction came true. So from there, Congress demanded briefings. They ultimately held a few informational briefings, albeit behind closed doors. These weren't briefings that were held before congressional committees. And ultimately, not a lot of information from these meetings got out. We were able to get kind of just generic bullet points from the meetings, but not actually, we weren't able to attend the meetings themselves or get recordings of them, unfortunately.
What does the Grizzly Flats community make of the Forest Service briefings to Congress? I mean, it reached the highest levels of government.
Well, definitely at first, there was a sense of feeling, you know, heard and an optimism that there could be greater transparency around this issue, not just for Grizzly Flats, but for other communities too. Part of something that that Congress demanded of the Forest Service was to basically create a list of other towns, other projects where there was a similar scenario, where they wanted to get work done, but it wasn't happening. And, you know, the idea was to prevent another Grizzly Flats in the future. But as the process developed, community members in Grizzly Flats were telling me they were feeling frustrated. They felt like there wasn't transparency around this. They wanted to hear what was being discussed in these briefings. They wanted to be involved if possible. They would have loved to have, you know, posed questions or, you know, consulted with Congress members' offices to give their point of view. Ultimately, that didn't happen. And not only that, the Forest Service had planned a meeting with members, residents and former residents of Grizzly Flats. But ultimately, that meeting was canceled at the last minute, and it hasn't been rescheduled. So definitely a feeling of frustration that's lingered. However, there is legislation in Congress that is making its way through the process. There's a piece of legislation that would significantly streamline getting forest management and fire prevention work done. That could be a game changer potentially in trying to prevent this type of thing from happening in other communities. There's also a piece of legislation that would require more transparency and more accuracy with how the Forest Service tracks its work. Because ultimately, if you can't measure properly what work's getting done, you can't assess what else needs to happen and how successful your efforts are. So those pieces of legislation have referenced our investigations, and there is some sense of reassurance with some members of the community that at least that's in the works. But what I hear is they wish there was a bit more transparency around the conversations.
And Scott, as this is happening, rebuilding and recovery is still continuing and ongoing. And as we know from wildfires in recent years, it is a long road to get back to any sense of normalcy. In the 2 years since the Caldor fire happened, I mean, you've stayed in touch with people, with survivors, some who chose to rebuild while others moved elsewhere. What stands out to you about how recovery has been for them?
Slow. The word that comes to mind is slow, and fits and starts for the people who are fortunate enough to start to rebuild. There are a lot of people who are still living in trailers and RVs on burned out properties 2 years out, and they're not sure what they're going to do. They're not sure what their path forward is. A lot of people, this was a community of modest means, and a lot of people could not afford fire insurance because the cost of premiums has just skyrocketed in recent years. For the folks who, it's hard to say that they're fortunate because they lost everything, but I suppose more fortunate where they had fire insurance and have some means to start rebuilding, that process is very slow. I was just texting someone this morning, a woman named Eileen, who is rebuilding on the mountain, and she's hoping to finish laying the foundation at the end of the week for her new house. And we're talking 2 years out and laying a foundation. Not only that, you know, services up there are spotty. Cell service can cut in and out, especially during storms. PG&E is undergrounding electricity lines up there, which seems to have support of community members who are still up there. But even that is proving, you know, complicated. There were a number of times where people lost power up there for, you know, stretches as they were doing this work. And so it's just been a struggle for people up there. Not a lot of people realize that, you know, after a fire for months and years, the struggle continues. It's not just when the fire hits.
It's really hard to understand the financial toll suffered until you are faced with it yourself. I mean, for few people or some people, there's insurance, but as we've learned in recent years, that is often far from enough to rebuild. I mean, how has the financial toll impacted Grizzly Flats residents and Caldor Fire survivors?
Yeah, it's been a huge financial impact. You're right. For the people who have insurance, a lot of times that won't fully cover the cost of rebuilding. The requirements for rebuilding in areas that are fire prone have gotten a lot more strict. On the one hand, that makes sense. You know, rebuilding in those areas with fire resilient materials makes sense given our new reality with wildfire. At the same time, that makes it really difficult for folks who had insurance to then try to rebuild, and they come up against the reality that that new house is going to cost a lot more than what they're given by insurance companies. And again, there's the, you know, reality of folks who didn't have insurance, who lost everything and really don't have any recourse. And a big, you know, frustration among community members is that individual assistance from FEMA did not come through. The way FEMA works is they will provide assistance, reimbursement for things like debris removal and emergency response to local and state governments. And there has been a lot of money from FEMA that's been allocated as a result of the Caldor fire for that reason. We're talking tens of millions, you know, possibly over $100 million at this point. But individual assistance, you know, compensation or assistance that would go directly to individuals and families was denied. President Biden denied it. The state pushed again. They appealed it. And President Biden once again denied individual assistance. And that's been something that's been really frustrating for folks. There's a visit by President Biden shortly after the Caldor fire happened. And he made a remark, something to the extent of, you know, we will make sure these people are taken care of who were impacted. A lot of people in Grizzly Flats and elsewhere took that to mean we'll get individual assistance. So when that didn't come through, there was a feeling of feeling a bit slighted.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking with investigative reporter Scott Rodd about the aftermath of the Caldor fire, which ignited 2 years ago this month. So that brings me to the legal action some Grizzly Flats residents are pursuing. What is their argument?
Well, they point to the Forest Service and say, look, we believe that the Forest Service early on recognized this threat of wildfire against Grizzly Flats. Their fire models showed that if a fire ignited on their land, it could easily wipe out the town. They had a plan in place to protect the community through forest management, but that plan did not, you know, they didn't follow through on that plan. They also point to the response during the response during the Caldor fire and say that there was mismanagement on the Forest Service's end. And they also point to, again, FEMA, and they say, we this is a modest means community, and we didn't get any assistance, individual assistance from FEMA. So essentially they say, something's got to give here. I spoke to Marianne Cook. She and her husband lost their home in Grizzly Flats. They've since relocated to a coastal town because rebuilding for them just wasn't feasible. Here's what she had to say.
I didn't feel that we were given any support by the government or by FEMA. We were promised FEMA and it was turned down. So I felt at that point, our only last resort was to do an individual claim against the U.S. Forest Service.
Scott, do you have any idea how many of survivors of the Caldor fire, they want to file a claim? What kind of outcome are they hoping for?
So Marianne Cook and her husband, Rick, have already filed a claim, and I've talked to organizers who are working with other residents to, in a concerted effort, file claims, and they have to get it in by the 2-year deadline of the Caldor fire, which is coming up soon. And so they the organizer said that, you know, they had estimated about 100, possibly more than 100 people will be filing these claims. And they're hoping for, you know, essentially power in numbers. And in terms of the outcome they're looking for, here's what Marianne Cook told me.
First of all, I would like everyone in Grizzly Flats to be compensated for the neglect of the U.S. Forest Service and also changes to their policies.
What is the Forest Service's response?
Oh, well, I reached out to the Forest Service requesting an interview. They declined. They said that they're not aware of any pending lawsuits against the Forest Service, which makes sense because folks need to file these claims first before they pursue a lawsuit if they decide to do that. So that makes sense. But in general, the Forest Service, you know, stands by their response during the emergency, during the Caldor fire, and they said that there wasn't mismanagement. And in terms of the planned forest management work, they acknowledge that very little of it got done. They say that it's hard to get that work done with shortages in resources, both people, person power, and money. And they also say, just given the reality of hotter temperatures, you know, it's risky to set things like prescribed fires. But, you know, I think quickly going back to Marianne Cook's comments, you know, folks at Grizzly Flats, they want to see compensation for people who lost their homes, lost everything for a lot of people. But they also, a lot of them want to see changes to U.S. Forest Service policies in order to avoid something like this happening again. You know, they see their town as a cautionary tale. We know that there are a lot of other small communities that are against that border Forest Service land and other federal land that are at risk. And these folks, these fire survivors, don't want to see it happen again to another community.
Scott, thank you so much for the update and all the work.
Of course. Thanks for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Scott Rodd is an investigative reporter, formerly with CAP Radio, but now based at KPBS in San Diego, updating us on the aftermath of the Caldor fire, which ignited 2 years ago this month, and how some Grizzly Flats residents are filing claims against the U.S. Forest Service. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Californians know all too well the significant threat wildfires pose, with the potential to destroy and change lives forever. They can also have a major ripple effect on our economy, from the damage to businesses, loss of employees, to distribution of supply chains, and impacting the stock values of companies. But a report from UC Davis reveals only a fraction of publicly traded companies mention this risk, which is required in disclosures to the Securities and Exchange Commission, or SEC. The report suggests a vast majority of public companies are not being as forthcoming about their vulnerability to wildfires and other extreme weather events as they should be, despite the risk it poses to them and our economy. Earlier this year, I spoke with Professor Paul Griffin with the UC Davis Graduate School of Management and lead author of the report. Professor Griffin, thanks for making the time today.
Thank you.
So you've been at UC Davis since 1981. You're an authority on accounting and financial information and disclosure, particularly in relation to climate change. How did you delve into this part of your field and your profession?
Well, my work earlier on was on, it's always been on corporate disclosure and what companies were telling shareholders and other stakeholders. But just over the years, it's been obvious that companies need to say more than just what they're doing financially. They need to talk about their environmental, social, and sort of governance issues. So I picked up on this about 10, 15 years ago. And then been working on it ever since. And so it's resulted in the sorts of studies you see today on wildfire disclosure. But I have other papers on heat waves. I have other papers on emissions disclosure. There's just a lot of additional environmental issues that companies need to think about. And tell the outside parties, investors, creditors, employees, other people, of what they're doing, what their responses are to some of these events.
When looking at the report that you just recently published in response to wildfires, I mean, you examined more than 80,000 filings between 1996 and 2018. When did this part of your research start for you? Was it a particular wildfire or event that took place in California, or did it gradually gain your interest over time?
I think what happened is that these events became clearly more severe and more frequent. And so and then the technology becomes available for us to pore over, like, again, 86,000 reports, and we can do that electronically. We don't have to do it manually, which we would have had to do in the past, which would have made it almost prohibitive to actually do that. But we can do that in electronic form now. And so we can study a large array of these regulatory reports and identify those who are what we call disclosers versus those firms that have been subject to a wildfire event, and we call those exposed to wildfires. So we can identify that too, not through the regular reports, but through geodata that's available through NOAA and other forms of data sets.
Give us an idea of the scope of your report in terms of how many different firms you examined, the types of companies you looked into, where they're located, and even the range of size of these companies.
Again, we're not constrained, other than they had to be public companies because they were giving these regular reports. So they had to be public companies. We're constrained somewhat by the availability of electronic data. So we had to start at the point we started at. And then we stopped in 2018 because we were working on this in 1920 and so forth. So it takes a couple of years to get the paper in shape and eventually become published. So that's where we stood, but it's a wide variety of firms. We've got the agriculture industry in there. We've got finance and banking in there. We've got the full array. We've got technology in there as well. So we have the full array of industries. We have a long time period, and we have firms of all sizes, so long as they're public companies.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we are well aware of the increasing and also the devastating risk that wildfires can pose to our state, destroying homes, businesses, impacting the supply chain, sometimes, you know, just nearly disseminating and destroying whole communities. But how do they affect our economy, both on a micro and a macro level?
Well, firms have different degrees of exposure to wildfires, depending on where they're located. They are going to have certain facilities in those locations. They could be factories, it could be warehouses, it could be headquarters and so forth. And so the wildfires can have a direct effect, right, because they're right there in the midst of very close to wildfire. Or they could have a sort of more of indirect effect through smoke and through employee not being able to show up and so forth, but through employees. So that's how these firms are affected. Now the question is, they've experienced wildfires before. What are they doing to build resilience and harden their headquarters? And there's been some cases where firms actually changed their headquarters, or they have a headquarter option B just in case headquarter A is damaged. So firms are taking actions. But as I said, from the conclusion of our study, they're not telling us, the average person or stakeholder of a firm, enough about what they're doing. And one of the reasons they may not be doing that is that they feel they might be giving information away to their competitors, since it could be proprietary, that they don't want to tell too much about the way they operate and where they're operating.
Hmm. How are companies supposed to disclose these risks and these vulnerabilities? What are the requirements?
The 10K under the securities laws, the 34 Act, was legislated way back in 1934 as a result of the Great Depression, and there are certain item numbers in the 10K requirements, and some of those item numbers require that a firm tell shareholders and investors about material risks they face. And those risks could be risks to the business plan. It could be risks to the infrastructure of the firm. There could be other risks associated with maybe a business strategy or the competition they face. So they are required to do that, but only if they meet the criterion of materiality. And so materiality is a sort of a moving target sometimes. Some people would say it's one thing, some people say it's another. And so often it's a judgment call as to whether a firm will view an event or events that affect their future operations as risk-related sufficient that's as material to be disclosed. And so it's not always the case that you can identify how the firm made their decision. They might have looked at a wildfire and say, well, it's not material, it really hasn't affected that much. Or they might say, yes, it really does. And in the future, it's likely to affect us even more, and therefore there would be a requirement to disclose. But for the firms that don't disclose, they would judge the wildfire event to be not material to operations. Mm-hmm. There's what we're observing is probably not enough enforcement of the rule for disclosure. Because the SEC and shareholders, they have many other things to think about and try to enforce these disclosures or add pressure for firms to actually make a fuller and more complete disclosure.
So the judgment on disclosure falls on the company?
Yes, it's a company decision subject to pressure by the regulators or pressure by shareholders for misrepresentation or omission of something that an outside party would think is material.
So that brings me to a part of your study which found that when filing wildfire risks in federal filings with the SEC, some firms are instead placing them in non-specific risk disclosures. What exactly is that, and what is the strategy behind that?
Yeah, we call that boilerplate as a general term for that, in the sense that the firms feel they're satisfying the rules and regulations for disclosure by putting it into a very general category. So they can defend that by saying, well, we considered it, but we put it in this general category. And there's some actually legal opinions, I won't get into the detail, but some legal opinions that would actually uphold the legality of that form of disclosure, even though there could be a wildfire event that required disclosure. The boilerplate is not necessarily considered illegal or inconsistent with securities laws. But you do see that, and that's often a disclosure people make. But that would not be picked up by our study because we're looking for specific disclosures of wildfire and wildfire-related words.
Is this done overwhelmingly in terms of not disclosing or filing the wildfire risks and vulnerabilities?
There's probably more of it than we'd like. But remember, the SEC, the Form 10-K document for the typical company is about 300 pages of text. And so firms are always looking at, do I need to put more in or can I put in less in, and can I summarize in some ways? And so you can see that there's an argument that some firms say, well, there's too much information. It's not going to do anybody any good because they're just going to be overwhelmed. Too little information is probably not good either. So there's that Goldilocks sort of balance that firms are looking for. And some firms would include specific disclosures in that balance. Others would say, no, I'm going to put it into the general boilerplate category.
Hmm. Are there some companies that are kind of a case study in the research and that you're doing in terms of this?
Well, there are a number of studies that would be good as a way to demonstrate some of the sort of the themes or the ideas that we have in our paper. Obviously, PG&E is one because they've had wildfires and they've had litigation, and their pre-wildfire disclosure was somewhat, I think, subpar in terms of what you'd expect. But there are other cases in Northern California. Some of the wineries, for example, would have been devastated by the fires of a couple of years ago, and so they would have an event which would 100% call for disclosure because it's a significant event, and everybody will realize that's a significant event, so it's got to be in the reports. But we have to think of it as a distinction between disclosing an event which occurred, mm-hmm. and disclosing the future risk associated with those events that will occur in the future, but yet to have occurred. So we have to. There's that distinction. And again, what we're finding is that there's more likely to be disclosure when there's an event. There's less likely to be disclosure when there are these events that could occur in the future with with wildfires with increasing frequency and increasing severity.
Mm. You and your colleagues were encouraged, though. There are some firms that are acknowledging this risk of wildfires. Which companies are they, or what kind of examples in terms of the actions that they're taking to disclose the risk and also what they're doing to mitigate the risk of wildfires?
That question, it's a good question, but it's not the focus of our research. We're looking at a large sample, and it would be just overwhelming for us to look in each individual company and whether they did the right thing, did the wrong thing, are they compliant with the securities laws or not. So we don't have that. We know the California firms, we know the different states, and so in the western states we're seeing more responsiveness. In California, we're seeing a little bit more responsiveness relative to the western states. But we also have responsiveness in areas like Texas, Florida, and even up in the northeast have had wildfires. So it's a national phenomenon. Well, it's global, but our study was national in terms of the sample we look at. We don't have those specific examples in our study, because that wasn't the purpose of the study.
Would you go as far as to say that there are some companies that you would consider bad actors?
I'm sure there are. it's not my job to name those bad actors.
What are some of the consequences faced by a company, stockholders, communities, when the companies where they're headquartered or where they're saying they're headquartered, if these wildfire risks aren't properly disclosed?
What's interesting in one of the results I found surprising, not what we might have expected, and that is that the firms that you would consider, quote, good firms that had wildfires and disclosed the wildfire and perhaps made a disclosure about wildfire risk, we call those the discloser firms. And relative to the non-discloser firms that also were subject to wildfires, the valuation, the fair valuation, the market valuation of the firms that were disclosers deteriorated relative to those that didn't say anything. So in a sense, you're being transparent, you're being forthcoming, but that's not necessarily going to serve your shareholders in a positive way. There's a little bit of a sort of a disconnect there, and I'm sure that's what firms think about when they're deciding to disclose.
They may take a little bit of a hit.
Yeah, that they might take a hit, but the other side of that is by taking a hit, they're signaling that they're much more forthcoming, a transparent firm, and they should get a positive result from that as well. So there's two sides to that.
Why should this matter to the general public?
It matters to the general public because these firms are part of our environment. We depend on these firms for services, for products, and we want those products and services to be priced appropriately and not having to pay for, decisions or lack of decisions made by firms when they could have made those firms to make the product better or more resilient or make the operations more resilient. So we're affected, you know, in terms of what we buy, what we use.
Mm-hmm. Does your study and your research come with any recommendations in terms of the types of fire prevention and disclosure steps you recommend?
Recommendations would relate more to consideration of the current policy and whether that could be tightened to be more specific about what giving guidance to firms as to what they should do and to increase the information to the public on what those risks are, because as I indicated earlier, some of those risks are hidden, and they're hidden either through boilerplate or not at all for the very large majority of the firms we studied. Mm-hmm. They're hidden risks. Risks should not be hidden. They should be more transparent and more forthcoming on their information.
Is there enough accountability?
That's the same thing. We would like to see more accountability. We'd like to see firms indicate what they're doing, right? But they will look at that and say, well, wait a minute. It's potentially, if I tell everybody what we're doing, what we plan to do, I may be giving away information to my competitors, and that's not good for anyone.
Have you received any response or comment from like the SEC or public companies or firms?
Not from the SEC, although I know that my work is read by the SEC. But in one case, there was a reporter in another session that I did talk to a particular firm and said, well, does the SEC require that you disclose wildfire? And this person said no, but it was correct. But the question should have been, does the SEC require that you disclose material wildfire events or material risk? And the answer is going to be yes. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to see more clarification on materiality so it can help firms make those choices, all right, make the correct choices.
We're talking about companies and whether they disclose wildfire risk, but more broadly, there is extreme weather and climate change, and you've been looking into this for decades. How did you first become connected to this type of research? And I would imagine it has probably evolved significantly in the decades that you've been focused on this.
Well, it's interesting. In the late 1970s, and I was a very, very young researcher at that time, I was actually asked by the Securities and Exchange Commission to do a study on bribery because there was concerns that American firms were paying bribes to international firms to gain business and so forth. And so at a very young age, I became interested in whether firms were making sufficient disclosure about the way that they were making payments. We called them facilitating payments in those days. Again, a euphemism. To what extent were they disclosing that? And those numbers being quite small relative to billion-dollar sales, however, material, because they talked about the way in which the firm was managing its operations. So I've been really thinking about these issues, you know, for my entire career.
And this recent study has gotten interest from not only across the country, but in other countries as well, right?
I'm getting calls from Europe as well, yes.
What does that signal to you?
It signals that this is a global issue, not an American issue or not a California issue.
How do you want listeners to think about this research and potentially maybe even any proactive steps they can do to protect themselves when it comes to choosing which companies to invest in?
Well, the public out there buy products, as I said before, and they use services that are offered by these companies. And so it doesn't require that much more to find out what these companies are doing to mitigate, disclose, manage the various climate risks they face. That could be done through general public media, or it could be done through reading some summaries of these particular statements or documents I look at. But once read that, that using either social media or other means to apply some pressure to these firms to change their ways, make more fuller disclosures about these risks, because they are important and they're driving markets. We know that. And there's ways the firms can benefit by being more transparent and more forthcoming on these disclosures. So if the firms benefit, the consumers benefit.
Professor Griffin, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you very much.
That's my conversation with Professor Paul Griffin with the UC Davis Graduate School of Management and lead author of a report which found that despite the increasing risk of wildfires to the economy, many public companies are not disclosing this risk to the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is federally required. Our conversation first aired in January. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Music is transformative and has the power to overcome many of life's challenges. But for kids and young adults experiencing homelessness or housing insecurity, finding opportunities to realize this potential and creativity can be few or virtually non-existent. But an organization in Sacramento has been providing a safe haven for them since 2015, cultivating an atmosphere where they can create, discover, and dream big. The Creation District offers a wide array of workshops and programs for Sacramento's youth to help them build a brighter future for themselves and the community. Joining us now to tell us more about this incubator for creation is Grace Loescher, director of the Creation District. Good morning, Grace.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start off with how the Creation District, how it was created. What is the origin story?
Sure. So the Creation District is blessed to be under the umbrella organization of Waking the Village, which has been doing radical work here in Sacramento, supporting youth and young adults experiencing homelessness for 2 decades. And the Creation District was really born out of this idea that so many of the programming in Sacramento that supports youth experiencing homelessness is really focused on just getting their basic needs met, which is radical and important. But the Creation District wanted to go a step forward and make sure that we were really honoring youth's identity, their creative visions, their hearts, their souls, their wildest dreams, and finding space for that. So we've moved from offering workshops out of a classroom to offering workshops out of a mobile van and shelter bathrooms to finally getting our own building in downtown Sacramento 2 years ago.
How did you become connected with the Creation District?
Sure. So it's kind of been my lifelong vision and dream. And I moved to Sacramento to be able to do this. I was blessed to start out working as a case manager, supporting youth and young adults who were pregnant or parenting at Waking the Village. And then they were incredible mentors, helped me to begin to start and build this program underneath that and turn it into the artistic creative haven that it is today.
Mm. You know, given that you had a background in helping, you know, youth that are vulnerable for a myriad of reasons, I mean, what led to, I think, you leading the Creation District was probably you saw some gaps in how they are being taken care of and what support was offered and what support was not offered.
100%. It was incredibly frustrating to me to see that so many of these young adults, 18, 19, 20, were being forced into lifelong system dependency, minimum wage jobs, and nobody was helping them kind of dream and believe that they could be anything that they wanted to be and that there was so much more out there. And I think that having space where you can really cultivate and reflect and think beyond those boundaries and really like, what do I want to do with my life and what do I want to be, and have somebody tell you that all of those possibilities are on the table for you was really, really important to me.
So this was created back in 2015, and the Creation District was actually on Insight in September of 2018. So that's about 5 years ago. You know, how has the organization grown in that time?
Oh my gosh, so much. It feels like the last couple of years have been such a whirlwind. The time that we were back on Insight, we were kind of just beginning our record label. And at that time, we were trying to record out of our friends' closets or out of shelter restrooms, just wherever we could find space. And the program just caught on really, really quickly. We started having lines out the door of youth. We had wait lists for our recording program that were like months and months and months long. We were lucky the city of Sacramento invested a bit. And we were able to grow and now have our own recording studio, and we're able to offer daily sessions. We're serving an average of like 450 young adults a year. Really, really special.
What kind of programs and workshops are offered?
Great question. So in downtown Sacramento, we have daily drop-in programming. We're open Monday through Friday, 9 to 4. So youth can just kind of come in, bang on the drums, mash up some clay, paint a canvas. And then we also offer a continuum of workshops that are taught by local artists. And all of them have a different creative medium and then have a different social-emotional component. So we might have working with and processing trauma through stand-up comedy, processing anger through clay, even the mindfulness of juggling, whatever it is. And they rotate based on the artists that come through and what the youth say that they want.
And is there a cost associated with this?
It's all completely free. All the recording sessions are free. All the workshops are free. All the shows are free. We have a big, big value that art should be for everybody, and everybody who participates there can come through.
Yeah, that is just wonderful because, I mean, you talked about trauma, and trauma is often attached to, you know, these life experiences at a very, very young age. But you get a front row seat to how transformative creativity can be to help people heal and dream bigger than maybe what they were given or surrounded by at a very young age.
Oh, 100%. Similar to the way that narrative therapy works, I think that creativity offers us a space to be able to be the authors of our own life story, right? And through music, through songwriting, through poetry, through dance, you get to tell the story that you need to tell, and you get to be the sole character. And it also offers us just a space to have psychic relief from the pain of this life every day. If you're going through a lifetime of continuous and compounded trauma, to get an hour in the recording booth where nobody's asking you about your housing status, your income status, can be life-saving.
Mm. So you did bring some music music to share with these young artists, very talented. The first is Siler Galvin. Tell us about them.
Oh my gosh. I've known Siler for now maybe 7 years. Incredible, incredible young person. He started out taking guitar lessons at the Creation District 7 years ago and now has been writing his own guitar music, writing his own poetry. He's performed in 2 Creation District album release shows with us, one at Harlow's, one at the Ace of Spades. Incredible, incredible young man.
Well, let's listen to Feel 2.0. Ways does this music and this creativity empower young people like Siler, you know, to overcome just the daily challenges of life?
I think it's really, really, really essential for everybody, but especially for young people who are experiencing continuous crisis, to have a space where they walk through the doors and nobody is asking them constantly about that crisis, where they just get to be their sole identity as an artist, as a musician, as a poet, as a dancer. I also believe that the Creation District offers a space for people to heal in community. And I think that as human beings, we need community to heal, right? We need fellow artists. We need people to listen to us and hear us and see us. And I think that's one of the primary elements that happens there, that you get to have shared space and move through pain and move through grief and move through joy with people who love you.
We're going to listen to one more. This is from Cassidy Rose, and it's called Worthy. Tell us more about Cassidy and their growth.
It's one of my favorite songs of all time. Cass worked at the Creation District for a year as a peer mentor, as part of our peer mentor program, Project Heal, where youth create music about mental health and wellness and use that as a tool, an outreach tool, to help other youth move through their mental health journeys. So she created the song during that and put it on our Project Heal album, and it has truly helped me heal.
Well, let's listen to the song. It's called Worthy.
You used to tell me you love me. You used to tell me I'm worthy. That the side of the grass is greener on your side. That was a whole damn lie. If you're gonna tell them everything, tell them about how much I loved you and all the things that we used to do under the sky that we always talk to. Just me and
wow. That is incredible. It is so powerful. And that must just be so wonderful that you get to visibly see or take in this uplifting feeling, you know, walking in, maybe feeling a little down, having this cathartic kind of release with creativity and hopefully feeling like a million pounds lighter.
Oh, 100%. It is impossible to describe what it is like to be in the Creation District if you haven't walked through those doors, but it's a really sacred feeling in a really sacred community.
Finally, Grace, how do you want to grow?
Great question. I have big, big, big dreams for the Creation District. I would love to be able to create overnight shelter space. Sacramento has a big, big lack of emergency shelter for youth experiencing homelessness in the city, especially post-pandemic. So I'm eager to create a creative safe haven where youth have space for that overnight. Also, I would love to watch the Creation District grow outside of Sacramento. I believe that I've seen incredibly transformative results. The community here is really special, unlike what I've seen anywhere else, and I'd love to see that grow into other cities.
How can people help?
Great question. If you visit our website, thecreationdistrict.com/donate or /get involved, both of those have avenues for support. Right now, we have a GoFundMe campaign that we're launching to build out our recording studio so that these young artists can get the professional tools that they deserve and we can grow our reach to help more artists. So please, please check out our website, support us. We'd appreciate it.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for stopping by, Grace.
Oh, thank you so much for having us. It's been a privilege.
It's a great way to end the show. Grace Loescher is the director of the Creation District, telling us about a unique space for teens and young adults who are housing insecure or experiencing homelessness, creating a safe haven that allows them to realize their creative potential. And that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. If you want to join the conversation, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producers Nick Dobis and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Antonio Munez. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. And I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
But our biggest mistake are the ones that we don't make.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.